So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, everyone, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm senior editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm reviews editor Sherlyn Lowe.
Today, we're going to be talking about the future of work, which is something we've heard a lot about this past year. But I think this week it gets even more interesting because Microsoft introduced something called Microsoft Mesh, which is sort of their view of a futuristic remote collaboration, virtual meetings, software. And to talk about that, we have a great guest on, but before we get there, just want to say thank you for listening to the Engadget Podcast. Please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. You can always email us at podcast@engadget.com. We may bring your questions into future episodes. So Microsoft Mesh, what the hell is this? To help us break it down. Well, first, let's bring in Scott Stein from CNET, CNET editor at large, to chat about this. Scott, how are you doing?
Hey, great. It's great to be here virtually. It's good to be on.
Good to chat.
It's our future.
Exactly. And we always like to get people on from different corners of the tech world. I want to ask you up front, Scott, I know you've done a lot of coverage around VR and mixed reality and AR. And, you know, I followed your coverage for a while now. Can you give us like just a quick setup? What is Microsoft Mesh exactly?
Sure. So this is like the promise, I feel like, of what HoloLens was going to be.
Yep.
And why it feels like in a lot of ways we've seen this before, yet have we really? So it's really just a way for a lot of people to get together in one virtual space that agrees with each other. And and Microsoft's like umbrella for that is really large. Mm-hmm. Like the demos that we got to do, which we'll talk about later, were on HoloLens and AR. The keynote was in VR through their Altspace VR social app that they acquired. And they also want to fold in all other VR headsets, practically, right. Phones that are running AR or not, 2D screens. So it's kind of like imagining Microsoft Teams expanded into cartoons and virtual things. Optionally, you could, basically it's the Marvel, it's this whole thing of like the Marvel holograms around the table,
sure.
You know,
where
they're trying to make that happen. And what are the drawbacks and what are the magical possibilities of it?
Yeah, and I think on a higher level, right, it is Microsoft Mesh is not a specific piece of software. It's not an app. It is a platform that Microsoft is going to let other people develop for. So I think the way they likened it to me, I was talking to Greg Sullivan, their head of mixed reality, during my meeting last week. And it was basically like he said it was like Xbox Live. It was a way that Xbox Live kind of unified game console multiplayer and connectivity. And that may sound like boring work, but before the Xbox and certainly before the Xbox 360, getting a game console online, getting networking into games was really tough on the console level. And Xbox Live kind of simplified that. It gave developers a way like, hey, this is how you do networking. This is how you do multiplayer. We have this whole thing set up. Just plug into this. So Mesh is this thing that other developers can start using down the line to power their remote apps and do all sorts of things. Scott, we've seen, both you and I, we've seen Spatial, right? The virtual meeting software. How does that differ from what Microsoft is doing? Because I like Spatial. It's very cool. And they actually just recently opened it up and added like support for phones and computers too. But it seems a little more restrictive than this idea, this sort of like cross-platform, cross-device virtual meeting space that Microsoft is building.
Well, I think that's exactly it. Like right now, you're seeing a lot of companies, and Spatial's definitely at the forefront, mm-hmm. reaching out to a lot of devices that Spatial works on. So Spatial, in a similar way, works with 2D devices, works with Oculus Quest, HoloLens. They're pretty much everywhere. Mm-hmm. But Spatial is one app, pretty much. So, you know, it's like they're folding in a lot of other work cloud services into it. And I'm sure Spatial, like a lot of other companies, I'm guessing, would want to branch out even more.
Exactly.
So I think there are a lot of players in this space. But what Microsoft is looking at is more, like you said, more of that framework. So I think that what they're looking at is not so much one meeting area, although that could be Altspace VR or future Teams or whatever it might be. But, you know, they had partners like Niantic doing the Pokemon Go demo. You know, they have their own world map strategy. So I think the idea is you hook in the service to that. So I think that's what makes it pretty different, especially compared to, you know, I think one of the biggest VR players out there that's aiming for AR with Facebook, where, you know, the big question is Facebook seems to want to be putting everything into Facebook's world. But how much is Facebook going to reach out? And Microsoft is making a big bid to reach out to everything else.
It is sort of, it is the difference between Macs and PCs, right? And the way Windows powered multiple different types of hardware, multiple manufacturers and whatnot. Macs were just Apple. And it seems like we keep seeing that battle play out again and again. But let's take a step back. We both previewed this stuff. And I assume you got that giant Pelican case from Microsoft last week, too. Let's talk about that and what those meetings were like. So what did you get in your box?
Right. So, I mean, it's funny. It's like, this is a gigantic box of stuff. This is like the closest thing to like trying to simulate a home virtual experience. So they sent this like loaner kit of this, of just a gaming PC, a HP Reverb G2, which are stuff I had already.
Yeah.
But I
yeah.
think we're already like, these were like specifically hooked into launch smoothly into the pre-build for all the stuff. But the really interesting thing for me was the HoloLens 2, because to this point, Microsoft had never let the HoloLens 2 outside to anyone to play around with, as far as I know. It's been really just a handful of demos I've had. So that was, it's been, was really fun and interesting to see what it would be like in my home to use it. And the and then from there, there was like a two-part experience. One, which I wrote about is the, well, I wrote about both, but like, one was really HoloLens based, where Alex Kitman, technical fellow, who's basically heading the mixed reality larger picture, beamed in and connected with me, and I did a demo of him with him of mesh in my cluttered office. So what that looked like was, you know, cartoonish, like, you know, this, but very well pinned. So it was this table that appeared, and then he hovered in, and we met. And on his end, they did capture of what it looked like on his end with like nice capture equipment. But the second part
he looked realistic, right? Like that's the thing. Like he looked photorealistic. I didn't have that meeting, but I saw like what he looked like during the keynote. He walks into this box, which is just surrounded by cameras, right? And it basically holoports him. Holoportation was the word Microsoft was trying to kind of convey to us. But yeah, he steps inside this box. He gets projected into this experience, and you can see his full 3D self, and he's just standing in your room as a hologram, basically, right?
So what's interesting is that that realistic part did not happen in my demo. So it's like two different levels. He appeared as the cartoon, you know, and that was, you saw this on the keynote. If you watch the Altspace VR, or if you see it online, if you've been in Altspace VR, where you have basically these cartoon avatars, it's like, you know, also Oculus has them. There's a lot of these things because you can't scan your body in easily. So he appeared as that. And then, so it was really just cartoon Alex Kitman. And then hovering without, you know, without legs. And then to him, I created an avatar for myself, which looked ridiculous, like cartoon sort of me. And then we didn't actually see the real selves. But what he was showing on stage, like you said, is a very interesting, like, kind of next stage move that they're exploring, which is like the holoportation, which they were doing, I think, with an array of Azure Kinect cameras, you know, like the depth sensing, like a significant kind of a array that would capture you from all sides. But the idea is that you could do this with a just one, or even there was conversation about this happening with just a 2D camera with software and AI down the road. And there's stuff like that on phones a little bit. So I think what the, but then of course you have to set up a camera to do that. So it's kind of like it wouldn't be in your headset. Microsoft, it was showing that on stage before and after in this crazy dance party thing. But then also was one small note is that if you went to the Burning Man experience in Altspace VR last summer, it turns out they were like test driving this tech. So they said like some of the stuff for mesh was kind of being explored experimentally there, especially Diplo and Bertrand, who was a like really active social presence on Twitter. they had this holographic presence. So they were basically doing the same thing, but like last summer. But I'm thinking about it because I'm going, were they using the same thing? I think so.
Yeah, yeah. Scott, can you tell us more about like what this experience was like in your home? Because I did a little bit of this too. I got a HoloLens 2 to test out. I went into this meeting with other journalists and Microsoft's head of mixed reality. It was really interesting, right? Because there was a virtual table in front of me. There were people all around me. I was just sitting right here at my desk as usual, but it felt like I was actually doing a briefing, like a group briefing like we used to in person with other people. Did you get any sense of that with your demo?
Yeah, definitely. And it got to the point where, and I've only experienced this one other time with like, again, like that Spatial was working on this thing with where the AR, they were going to have AR people moving around your home. I found that, that idea when you have AR stuff moving around a real space, not only was it pinned really well, so I felt like the table like stuck and I was able to move around it really easily, but like my body language started to become more like walk around conversational. So I found like I got beyond the staring at a screen part, which I thought was really intriguing. And so that part, like the way it lingers in my memory, became really cool. You know, in a lot of ways, like the some things on the HoloLens hold it back, like the display on the HoloLens, obviously, like it, not a lot of people have seen it.
Yeah.
But not just a limited field of view, but it's a little bit rainbowy, hazy, you know, the way it does with waveguides. It's still finding its way, I think, in terms of versus the crystal clear type of resolution on modern VR headsets.
I think what you were getting at here is that the way you thought of this, right, the way you experienced it was different than maybe a meeting on your computer or in a VR headset. Like the philosophy nerd in me is thinking of like the qualia aspect of what this means, right? The experience of seeing other people around you and also having an AR headset, so you're still seeing the real world, right? It is like those things are around you in a very natural and organic way, right?
Yeah, that's the wild part too. And you mentioned still seeing the real world around you is the comfort of not just being able to talk with people, but like you can pull out your phone, although your face ID may not work. And, you know, and then you can just kind of check on things. Like I went and like closed the door and fixed some stuff. But I realized he just saw me he read the motions, but and knew what I was doing. And that's like a really, it's about kind of a comfort level of behavior. It's like the weirdest thing. It's not like there is some teleporting reality, but it's also like, think about like the Zoom fatigue for me is like the rigidity of like everything is straight on. And here it's like you can kind of chill out a little bit, you know, and talk and just do the things you would normally be doing. And I think that's really fascinating. Plus the ability to look at things. As you can start having virtual things to look at. We looked at jellyfish, a lot of standard immersive things, jellyfish, a giant whale.
There was like a model of the moon, a model of the earth that we were like passing around too. And even though the HoloLens display isn't perfect, it still looked like very high resolution. Like I could peek in there and see like individual craters on the moon and everything. I was going to bring this up towards the end, but I do think it's worth pointing out now, like Scott, there's a lot of talk about the Apple AR glasses and what, you know, having a nice pair of glasses that was digitally infused. Is this the sort of thing you'd like to see in a device like that? And do you think that would make those things more useful?
You mean like the type of thing I'd like to see? Or like a improved like hardware type of?
Improved hardware, but also like if you weren't just wearing a HoloLens headset, but in your glasses, you could just see these like virtual beings and holograms and stuff too. Like I feel like that would be a game changer for a lot of people.
Yeah, it would. And especially if it got to the point where the resolution... And I know Microsoft's continuing to work on stuff undoubtedly, that just crossing over that gap a little bit, you know, some of the micro LED tech, which I haven't really seen in action, but like, you know, I think that there is stuff to come display wise that's going to take it forward and work with our regular glasses. Although I really love that the HoloLens 2 fits over my glasses. I feel like that's still something I appreciate, that it's like, it's pretty accommodating, but it's more like a work visor. You know, I feel like I look pretty nerdy in a fun way.
Super nerdy. Yeah. Like, so you spent a lot of time with the Magic Leap headset as well. RIP Magic Leap. I know you've done a lot of coverage around them. How is this what the HoloLens 2 is doing versus what you were seeing from Magic Leap? Because I feel like that was the geek. That was like the ideal. That was the dream of pure augmented reality stuff beamed right to your eyes. But unfortunately, they couldn't keep it up.
Yeah, God, Magic Leap. You know, the hardest part with Magic Leap is I just got to demo it so few times. It was so locked down that, like, you know, the times I had it, the Magic Leap was cool in that it was, you know, so it looked so much more compact in a sense. But it wouldn't work with my glasses, so I had to get contacts every single time to use it. And yeah, I get my keep my disposable contacts at hand in case there was a demo. So that was annoying. They did have prescriptions, but it didn't go to my prescription. So. And then you have to get inserts. I think with Magic Leap, they had the controller, but they didn't quite prove out the hand tracking, you know, and that's something that Microsoft went really bold with having no controller for the HoloLens 2. Everything is done with your hands. And that's pretty hard because even with the Oculus Quest 2, which I feel like there's a lot in common between the Quest 2 and HoloLens 2 in the ease of use, that is hand tracking. But it doesn't feel as precise in the sense that I wouldn't feel comfortable using it all the time for everything.
Yeah, yeah. It's more like a nice added feature rather than the primary input, right?
Yeah, so I think that lends a really, like, that was the bet for Microsoft was to get a more real-life tactile feel. And I love, like, you know, tapping on my wrist to open the menu and tapping the buttons in space, which do things. Sometimes that gets a little, sometimes I want a shortcut.
It's weird, but
I don't think anyone's come up with anything better. And I think that it's like definitely the model for where I think things need to start with and go. So that's the big difference for me is like comfort, interaction is like nothing I saw in any other AR headset.
Gotcha. Let's move on to like what we saw at the Ignite keynote, which wasn't using HoloLens, at least for the viewers, right? That was Altspace VR on various VR headsets. And Altspace VR is this company Microsoft bought a couple of years ago. They were basically a struggling virtual reality collaboration company, similar to Spatial. Kind of, Microsoft kind of saved them. But they used that tech, and then they gave us a new mesh-powered version of Altspace VR that could see. Basically, could you describe it, Scott? Like, once you jumped into Altspace, what did you see for the keynote?
Yeah, so what I saw, it was hard to tell where the mesh played in at this point.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in the sense, Altspace already has these pretty elaborate virtual worlds, and Burning Man was a great example of that, how far it can go. But what you saw was this auditorium, and what was really cool is on stage, there was this whole, like, you know, virtual presentation where Alex Kipman appears as a hologram of himself, you know, the actual him wearing
photorealistic, like it looked very legit.
Yeah, like wearing a HoloLens. It's the sort of stuff you'd see in like an experimental Sundance like VR experience, like that was like produced but not versus like being live. And again, like at Burning Man, if you happen to see that Diplo concert or Baraton Thurston talking, they had that same thing. And I remember at the time being like, what the heck is this? I was like, I've never seen this. What magic? Tell me about this. So
what sorcery is this? Yeah.
Right. So then he presented this talk and then different things beamed in. You know, he had an aquarium around him. He brought in OceanX, the nonprofit, who's one of the early partners. They started showing VR things around, but then they also had some people again appear as holograms with that heliportation as themselves.
Heliportation.
And James Cameron appeared talking about Avatar 2 a bit and wearing it.
And also, he's tied to that show, right? Because I wrote this up a couple of weeks ago. So OceanX is doing the show called Ocean Explorer. James Cameron is a producer. And they basically create this high-tech boat that's going to go around the world and do a lot of cool stuff for underwater research. But apparently they are building what are they calling it? Like a VR? They're calling it like a holographic lab. Or
I think it's like a HoloLab or a
HoloLab.
They have a table there, which again is like that Marvel, or as I spoke with someone from OceanX about this, and they're very inspired by the tree scene in Avatar, you know, which is like they think of that model. But you know, you've seen this before in movies. the big virtual map appears and you all gather around it, Death Star plans or whatever else, and you figure out what to do. And they're building that on the boat, but also what's really cool is that it's going to use some of the submersible's 3D data and show you like the map of the floor of the ocean in real time, and they want to beam in people around the table. So that plays out. That's pretty cool. And
that's cool. And like researchers from around the world can all work together and view this data that the ship is collecting. Like that is the ultimate in remote work collaboration that they're envisioning here.
Yeah, yeah. So that was pretty wild. And then they had the demo conversation. John Hecke from Niantic came in, talked about Pokemon Go. Then they showed a concept video of first it was cartoon Alex Kipman, which again was like what I saw in the HoloLens 2. Then they show him moving around in the idea of like, you know, could you play Pokemon Go in the real world with glasses on with your magic gaming glasses? I got to talk with John over another Teams meeting or Zoom, I forget which platform it was. And then we talked about where they're going with this, and they're using the HoloLens 2 to model what future glasses gaming is going to be like. And because, again, I don't think there's a better example of AR glasses at the moment than HoloLens 2 for modeling these interactions.
Can we describe what you saw? Yeah. What we saw in the video was he walks through this park. He sees Pokemon just kind of wandering around, like the stuff I imagined as a kid. He sees a Pikachu jump in front of him. He opens his hand, pulls up a menu, which is how all the HoloLens menu work. And he feeds the Pikachu, and Pikachu is very happy. I can imagine this being like a thing we move towards after, you know, Pokemon Go on phones.
Yes.
We're looking at this right now, by the way, for the audio listeners. And I'm just like, the first thing I expected when we saw these Pokemon gathered at this person's feet was I wanted him to throw a Pokeball at them. But it still looks kind of janky. I think this is what Scott was talking about when you mentioned like you want some shortcuts. Like the menu still takes several steps. It's still like you drag and drop the ball towards the ground instead of holding it in your hand and tossing it. Like, we're still a little bit far.
I'm sure we'll get there.
From something that's a bit more intuitive. Yeah, I'm sure.
This video is just CG. This video is nothing of, like, the tech.
Not actual.
Yeah.
One thing that VR has in its corner is that most VR controllers have gamepad-like buttons. And they're really helpful because you can, like, do quick reaction stuff. And then in AR, it's like I have to reach out and grab things.
Right.
But the other interesting thing here is like not just the Pokemon, but what they're really trying to explore is what happens when you invite a friend to like holoport in next to you.
Yeah.
And as they were saying in the phone call or the chat, there's no real clear understanding for the metaphysics of that. Like it's very weird. Like I think about it when Alex Kipman was in my office, he couldn't see my office. And I couldn't see his office, but we had some things we agreed on. So if you're beaming in to play Pokemon Go, am I only seeing like your Pokemon in San Francisco, or are you seeing mine in New York, or are we like what the heck is going on? So I think that it's like you have to agree on space, and there's like three worlds. Yeah, it's weird. So in a sense, I think that's a laboratory experiment that they're trying to work out with an acknowledgement that there will be other players in the landscape.
Most definitely. It's funny because they announced earlier, a couple of months ago, that they're killing Minecraft Earth, I think in June or later this year. And that seems like Microsoft's big push to doing a Pokemon Go-like AR, VR world type thing. I can imagine that being amazing. That's in a device that's powered by Mesh, you know, and actually letting you step into Minecraft. Did you have much experience with that? Like, do you think that's something they could eventually bring back and revive and apply through Mesh and AR?
Yeah, it's surprising that that's happening with Minecraft, because I feel like it is very ahead of its time. And, you know, and I think that that's exactly the model. Like, Minecraft is, like, they have a killer app right in their pocket. And it is already being used in so many different ways, including AR and VR. So, yeah, I think it's a great place to start, especially since it's so versatile. You know, I think, like, block universe and collaborative and education, like, I think that's the way to go. But Microsoft, like, that's what surprises me, is there's a lot of starts and stops in the landscape. You know, Microsoft will start one thing and then not do something else, or I'm still surprised there isn't more movement in the VR headsets, or why aren't there consumer glasses, and Google moving away from AR and VR recently.
It's very weird. Xbox VR, yeah. Where is it? You know, like Sony says new PSVR is coming, but we still, Microsoft is not doing much for consumers aside from mixed reality headsets. Yeah.
It's baffling to just mm-hmm. because I feel that it obviously works on PlayStation VR. I mean, whether or not you want to use it, and you know, but it's cool. And Microsoft has all those tools. So like, it seems like, you know, it's just their decision at this point to figure out what they want to do with it. But the other players are moving and evolving. It's at this, I feel like it's this big AR VR poker game.
It's great. It's great. Competition is great, right? Everyone is kind of pushing forward. Let's just wrap up the keynote talk because something cool did happen, right? Like Alex Kipman, I think at first, as we were watching that initial holoportation version of Alex Kipman, it almost seemed like 2D to me, right? Because the audience was all on one side of the screen. You could not go around him. Towards the end of the keynote, we get transported to this the Burning Man-like world that you were talking about where you can freely explore the environment. And then there's Kipman, and then there's other people dancing in a circle, and you can kind of wander around them and see them in full 360 degrees. And then it's like, oh, yeah, they are rendering everything here, right?
That was really cool and and like absurd and interesting. Like I was self-conscious and also let myself go in it. But I didn't expect that everything would enter this interactive phase where you're kind of browsing around. And there was a recorded video around of people dancing mm-hmm. that were more 2D. And then there were cartoon avatars that were us in 3D. And then in the middle was this bonfire with Alex Kipman, Guy Laliberté, who's the founder of Cirque du Soleil, who's working mm-hmm. on this weird mixed reality immersive theater concept called Hanai World. And that it was like, and several other people were with them who I didn't know. And then they were all like holoporting and I got really close. Like you walk past and kind of feel like they should see you and that they were going to say hi. So it felt very successful in that regard, but everyone was casting beams into a fire and it was like a ritual. There was a dome of stars and then all of a sudden the keynote was over. And then we were like, oh, I guess we're going to go
back into the real world. It's a lot less interesting right now.
Like a keynote where you suddenly end up in a mystical fire ritual.
Hey, I mean, that's what I imagine always happening when I used to go to keynotes in California. Sherlyn, do you have any questions? Like, what's up?
Several. Like, I'm sure you've seen all this. So many things to ask and say. So one, when you were talking about the glasses and having that meeting in your shared mm-hmm. space, I'm surprised nobody made a Kingsman reference. I know the Marvel reference was made, but
not the first
literally,
thing.
Yes.
Kingsman. That comes to mind.
Come on. Kingsman. A lot of movies, they've done this where you
maybe
put on
Jarvis.
These like really,
very
light and thin looking glasses mm-hmm. and you're having a meeting with people around you around a table, Knights of the Round Table kind of. And that seems to be where we're headed, hopefully, even if it's still far away in the future. We had a question from our video director, Julio, wants to know, I guess he's all about making the big bucks here. Is there advertising potential in holographics and VR?
Don't ruin our beautiful holographic world before right. it's even begun. You're going to have to slay.
All the pop-up ads before you can see exactly. this person's face. You have to pay 50 cents or something.
There have been concept art videos about that, you know, like that's the dystopian mm-hmm. nightmare of being surrounded by all these things. Very Blade Runner-y. Sure. I think that's the battle, right? The battle over our eyes and our senses is like
yes.
afoot. And I think mm-hmm. that's even the whole discussion about Facebook and about like what they're going to do with all of the data, the questions about privacy and, you know, where do these controls begin and end?
Yeah.
I think there's going to be a lot of questions about that, because then you start letting that stuff in and sure, you got floating hamburgers and I don't know what else.
For sure.
There's definitely a way to monetize this. I mean, Julio added mm-hmm. on and said that all he wants to do is buy IRL skins. I think for your avatar, if you can buy some fresh fits, if you spend extra money, it's very Black Mirror-like, I think. Mm-hmm. But Dev, you were saying.
No. I mean, that is completely true. I forget what I even was going to say, but so please go on. Any more questions, Sherlyn?
Well,
Sorry, go ahead, Scott.
Oh, no, I was going to say, going into the skins, that's a really good point. I think maybe the analogy for ads may be right in front of us with video games. You know, it makes me think mm-hmm. about, you know, look at Fortnite, look at, you mm-hmm. know, for example, I think maybe that's like the ad model, you know, where you have like branded things that come in and you get cool gear and stuff that, you know, there's like a trade-off with it. versus just being bombarded. Like if you bombard with advertisements, nobody's going to go there anymore. So like you lose.
I even have like this awful scenario in my head where like, God, there's going to be real drops of like sneakers for the sneakerheads in the real world. And in the fake world where you want to buy a pair of shoes for your avatar and you got to line up in the virtual store or a PS5 drop in the virtual world. So like that'll be awful. Dev, did you remember what you were going to say?
No. Let's move on.
NFT holographic items.
Never exactly. We're getting there.
Exactly. Well, we didn't talk about this on the Tribeca Sundance episode of the podcast, but I wanted to initially talk about this. Scott, me, you, and Devendra, we're actually in this shared space in VR for Tribeca Sundance, and you and I shared a virtual hug. I don't know if you remember this.
It was great.
But I was like, here's the thing. I was going to say that like the experience, though, leaves me feeling like there's still a lot to iron out here, right? Like there were issues with the Sundancing, and granted, they're not Microsoft, but there were issues there with like multiple avatars bearing your name popping up because what, the server had an issue, you had to relog in and your dead avatar is just standing in a corner staring at a wall, whereas your actual live avatar is running around. Meanwhile, also kind of strange is the like idea that next to your avatar is your name, or on top of your head is your name. So like when I was looking for Scott, I wasn't so much looking for your face on your stick figure avatar. I was looking for your name. And that's not how the real world works, I don't think, right? We don't run around with name tags above our heads.
I wish we did, because then I'd remember people's names. So that'd be a lot easier.
would help a bit. Yeah, it was super wonderful and awkward. Like, and I think that's the whole Sundance thing too. When I came out of that, and like I got mixed reactions when I said this, but I felt like the superstructure of the experience, the semi-broken nature of it, was like the most interesting piece of art. Like, I don't mean that to offend any of the artists doing. Like, I think the art experiences were great, but like. Yeah. It was so weird to try to do this at home and load the builds of things and things would break and you're troubleshooting over Zoom. And like, you know, I think that's like, it really felt experimental. So that's what you're saying. Like, this is an off-road type of a thing, even if you have experience in VR stuff. And, and so I think that's like a real challenge. If you're going to get to this future, you need to have the stuff work without, even with the Microsoft stuff, there's a lot of hands-on guidance that takes still takes like an hour to get through. And so like, we're obviously not there and we need to cross that.
Yeah.
Sometime.
It's easy. It reminds me of like the beginning of the internet too, when like, getting an ISP, setting everything up, it was so hard and difficult. And then all of a sudden we had broadband and we had like a lot of things that made internet access easier for everybody. So we're kind of getting there. Yeah. But I do think if you're somebody who listens to the Engadget podcast, if you're a kind of techie, I feel like this is the most interesting time, right? Because you get to see everything built, you get to see the nuts and bolts, and you get to see like how this new medium starts to reshape itself and how it like incorporates new rules and whatnot. So yeah, it's very exciting, even though we talk about so many things being broken. Sherlyn, Scott, anything else you want to add about Microsoft Mesh or where all of this is going, you think?
I think it's super interesting to think about, like, we spent a whole year indoors, like, away from people. And I think we talk about, like, what we did to get by with work. And, you know, I've explored VR and AR, but a lot of my work tools, like, they've all had to be not VR and AR because no one else is there. But I think companies are trying to solve not just VR and AR, but like how you evolve these pretty limited tools that we've had. And so there's a big push, and it's coming from all different directions, gaming and otherwise. So I think that's porn. What's so interesting.
Truly porn. Truly.
Right.
Yeah.
So like all this stuff, this is the point at which virtual starts for a lot of people. And I think that's what's really intriguing is like, you can go back to the whole history of VR and AR, but it's kind of being rebooted now. And I think I'm really excited in seeing that, how it reverberates off the companies and what people figure out, resetting my own baked in expectations too.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the Engadget podcast, Scott. Where can people find you on the internet for more of your coverage?
Oh, sure. Well, at CNET, I'm always writing and doing stuff there. Twitter at JetScott, where I put weird thoughts all the time. And and those are good. Those are the two best places, really.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's move out of the world of VR and AR. And actually, we were just talking about a bit about ads and what that could look like in the future.
Yep.
It turns out the ad world is kind of shifting beneath our feet right now because Google just announced some pretty interesting news about its mm-hmm. ad business. Sherlyn, can you give us like the explanation here? What's up?
Yeah. So, I mean, I saw that you covered the news for Engadget. Basically, a lot of the browsers in the business, including Apple Safari, Mozilla's Firefox, have committed to not supporting third-party cookies moving mm-hmm. forward. And for those who don't know, third-party cookies are what track some of your you know, preferences and your browsing behavior over the internet so that other sites can use them to tailor ads to you. And so with Safari and Mozilla saying Apple and Mozilla saying, at least like last year that they will no longer support third-party cookies and Google saying that in January last year too, this has sort of been in the works. But this week, mm-hmm. Google announced that it plans to, told the world mm-hmm. what it sees as the future of creating targeted ads for you without third-party cookies.
So basically, like the core of Google's business, right? The stuff that actually helped their search engine business was not the thing that propelled the company. It was ads. It was able to create personalized ads that track you around the internet. That is changing. And how is that mm-hmm. changing? Yeah.
So basically, there are like with third-party cookies sort of being phased out and the support of it being phased out across different browsers, all these advertisers and businesses that support these targeted ads have had to figure out what are we going to do, mm-hmm. right? And so there are some proposals around the internet about like using things like hashed emails and like if you agree to give your email address to like one website and another and another.
Let's find other ways to track you. Yeah.
Right. And like when I was listening when I was hearing about that, I was just like, that does not sound great either.
It doesn't sound great. Let me just say, this news has led to some really interesting quotes from Google. And I just want to shout this out here. Like, can you imagine these words coming from Google like last year, right? People shouldn't have to accept being tracked across the web in order to get the benefits of relevant advertising. And that's David Temkin, Director of Product Management for Google's Ads Privacy. He says, and advertisers don't need to track individual consumers across the web to get the performance benefits of digital advertising. This is bonkers. I would never expect Google to say this. Yeah.
It is Google taking a clearer stance. So basically, anyway, when I said using hashed emails, that's one of the proposals that came out on the internet. That's not what Google is saying. Using. In fact, Google is saying that it does not want to do that. Instead, when it announced that it would be no longer supporting third-party cookies, it said that it would be focusing instead on this thing called Privacy Sandbox, which mm-hmm. is its own set of tools that it's kind of accepting proposals for and researching to see what would be the best way to help advertisers still target you without you giving up your personalized tracking and data and that sort of stuff. So one thing that Google said this week it would be focusing on is this thing called Flock. And Flock, I'm trying to get the exact
federated
wording.
Federated Learning of Cohorts API. So it's all about groups.
So federated.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So federated is a word that like Google has used in a lot of different like ML stuff across the across mm-hmm. its product portfolio. But here, yes, FLOC Flock is federated learning of cohorts. The keyword there is cohorts, right? Mm-hmm. Basically, it's groups of 1,000 people and up that share similar interests. And so for them, it's like, let's say you like Nike shoes, then you're in the flock of Nike shoe lovers, and advertisers can choose to target flocks based on stuff like that. So I make shoes. Maybe I'm a competitor to Nike. Let's say I'm Adidas, I guess. I'm going to target the Nike shoe flock. Or if I make cupcakes, I'm going to target the muffin shoes.
Yeah.
Muffin shoes. Business idea. You heard it here first. So that's kind of going to be the way mm-hmm. Google is going to try to serve you ads in the future.
And by targeting groups, they can never see you individually. Right. Like your right. individual data is not going to be visible, which is that. Okay. I'm down with that. That seems good.
I agree. And one thing that has been made somewhat clear to me is that they won't, so far the goal is to not go smaller than 1,000.
Right.
So these cohorts are going to be at least 1,000 people and up so that you're not so identifiable. There's still a lot they're figuring out. It doesn't sound like they have intersectionality considered yet. Like they don't know mm-hmm. if it's going to be like, oh, Nike shoe lovers who live in this specific neighborhood. Even if that's like above 1,000 still, they're still figuring it out. But
right.
the support for third-party cookies in Chrome is phasing out over 2 years. So it'll happen fully in 2022. But Safari and Mozilla have already stopped. Like by default, Safari no longer supports third-party cookies. So mm-hmm. if you already hate relevant, so-called relevant ads being served to you, you can already kind of mm-hmm. use Safari, I guess, to avoid that happening.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other questions, like for me, the bigger question here is like, okay, so Apple, Mozilla, and Google are doing this, right? But Google's not the only one serving tracking cookies. Facebook has its tracking cookie across all of its different ones. That's why like Instagram is so scary. I mean,
yeah.
of course, part of it mines some information from what already exists out there in other third-party cookies. But like there's Facebook, and then there's Microsoft also makes browsers. Does Edge still support third-party cookies? Mm-hmm. I actually am not fully
Edge,
up to speed
Edge is based on
Edge.
Chromium now, so I do feel like they're going to follow whatever Chrome.
They're going to follow and follow phasing it out. Mm-hmm. And then there's no real other like huge browser in the space, mm-hmm. I don't believe. So mm-hmm. this is a shift in the way the internet works.
I would call it a disturbance in the force, right? It is the most powerful ad company in the world saying like, maybe the way we've been doing this for so long isn't correct. But my question for you, Sherlyn, is this genuine? Is Google doing this out of the kindness and goodness of their hearts, or is there like an ulterior motive here? Because they've definitely been hit by governments and others when it comes to privacy too.
Yeah, you know, I want to believe that people are good, and I want to believe that sure. you know people are just doing their best. And with Google, you know, the vibe that I get, and going on vibes now, the vibe that I get from like someone like Sundar Pichai is that mm-hmm. like, yeah, they're actually trying to do their best. But you're right, like without being called out by so many different governments or different regulatory bodies, would they have decided to do this? And if had Apple and Mozilla not started saying they would stop supporting third-party cookies, would Google have done it first? I highly doubt it. Like, yeah. I feel like they had to see someone else do it first to be like, oh yeah, we should be doing that. The truly bold move isn't being taken by Google, but they do recognize, I feel like, mm-hmm. you know, there's something that needs to be done.
And there's like, this kind of follows everything too. Like the European Union's like push for greater privacy across the web,
yeah.
GDPR and everything, kind of a flawed yeah. execution. A lot of people are complaining about that, but mm-hmm. I do think it kind of got the conversation going about what kind of world are we building here where, you know, these ads are so granularly targeted and tracking mm-hmm. people. And as these things become more ingrained in our lives, we were just talking about VR ads and AR ads, right? I don't want a highly mm-hmm. specific personalized AR ad floating around my house, you know, like that is some Black Mirror stuff for sure.
It's the thing where like the second you talk about something, like I remember one time I was talking to my friend about Rumble boxing for like a workout class. And the next yeah. thing I know, Instagram was serving me ads. And I was like, I didn't even type this anywhere. Did they listen to me?
How exactly?
How did it happen?
I can imagine that's like having a fight with your partner, right? And an ad just pops up. Couples therapy?
Right. That's what feels so invasive and intrusive. And that's what they're trying to avoid here. Now, I want to clarify that when you brought up GDPR, as a person whose understanding of the internet, it's a little bit, I think, different than most. Mm-hmm. I think I freaked out a little bit when they said like, oh, no longer supporting cookies. Because I was like, cookies?
Like, they're delicious.
Are used on a lot. Well, yes.
Yeah.
But they're also used in a lot of different like things. Like they store information for your logins to maintain a session that's authenticated mm-hmm. and like your shopping carts. So I was like, wait, no longer supporting cookies. If you were one of those people that thought so, no, they're just not supporting third party cookies. So mm-hmm. like if a website has its own cookie to authenticate a session and to keep that session authenticated, it will still be supported. It's just the cookies that are used from other sources like Google mm-hmm. that will no longer be supported on these browsers. So you can still have like some of those experiences. You don't need to think about, wow, the internet is really this like changing in the way we know it. And then the GDPR part of it, like I had questions too, right? Like GDPR is also based on cookies, right? It's like it's saying if you go to a website and then you are going to be tracking information and storing that on a cookie, you have to let the visitor agree or choose what cookies they're going to accept. And I was like, how does this work now? Do sites have to re-enroll? Do, you know, and my understanding is that Google is going to work on making sure it's compliant with GDPR still. So what I envision happening is that when this FOC-based method does start rolling out, you might see like a resurgence of these agreements you have to agree to all over again. What I'm thinking.
Seems like things are changing. We're going to be keeping an eye on this too, like just to make sure Google is actually doing what they say. But I think this is a major win for consumers. It's going to make life harder for online advertisers, for, you know, the online ad business. But they have been, let me just say, I have very little sympathy for them because they have been basically feeding off of our data for so long. It's a huge, huge industry. Things are going to be tough as we transition to more privacy, but I think it's going to be for the better, right?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it would just be less scary. Mm-hmm. You can, I've never been too super concerned, I guess, about like my tracking habit. I don't know what y'all are looking at on the internet, but I'm not really looking at bad stuff. That concerned.
Exactly.
But it is a win for privacy and like our own personal data being used to sell ads. And I think that that's where it feels like morally a little incongruous. So
yep.
This is a good move.
What else is going on from Google? Because I feel like I was hearing something about phone updates too, right?
Yeah. So on the product, on the hardware/software product side, Google has been announcing a bunch of news. Last week we heard about Android updates. This week we got Pixel specific updates. And reader, viewer, and listener, please bear with me when I tell you this, because first of all, the thing that jumped out at me in this set of updates was underwater camera mode. And I was like, oh, what's going to happen here? Underwater? It turns out Google partnered with a case maker called Kraken.
okay.
Unleash the Kraken, I think.
Release the Kraken.
And to make a case that is so, you know, powerful, it will withstand deep water pressures, which is a big deal. But then the way it was worded, Google was like, oh yeah, the camera will work natively with this case now. And I was like, can I slap another case on and still have the same experience? They were like, yeah, but like, this one's like going to be super clear. It's just basically they had like a purpose-made case made for the Pixel phones. That's it. Like, it's a $300+ case that you can take deep sea diving, and it will allow you to use the camera on the Pixel as like you'd like.
That's cool.
Great.
But this is why action cameras exist, people. Come on. Yeah.
Right. That and like, cool, slap on an IP68 friendly case, I guess, or 3ATM or 5ATM and take it to those levels too. Yeah. You'll be fine. Don't spend $300+ for a so-called.
A GoPro Hero 9 Black costs $350, you know, with the current discount. So,
and it's not just a case. Jeez.
Yeah.
There you go. But there are other updates coming to Pixels, one of which being Smart Compose coming to more messaging apps. So Smart Compose is this thing where you type a few words and then Gmail or Google Docs would suggest ways to auto-complete that sentence. So like if I'm going like, hey, Devendra, and then Smart Compose will suggest what's up with the podcast or something. Like if it knows the context and if it knows what you typically would say. So this feature is coming to apps like Android Messages, Verizon Messages. Verizon's our parent company, by the way. WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, some apps like that. So I guess it's about to get easier to type complete sentences on your phone. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I feel like they've been trying to do this for a while. I don't know what's up. I'm an iPhone user. I feel like iOS autocomplete has been getting dumber and dumber recently too. So yeah, I need some more. Mm-hmm. We need some more innovation around this for sure.
Well, that's probably because Google knows so much about you. But anyway.
Yeah,
true. Right. So there's a couple other features like new wallpapers for International Women's Day. And some charging, like when there's a new interface for when you put the Pixel on the wireless charging stand and that sort of stuff. Somewhat small set of updates, but if you combine it with the Android updates we heard about last week, we're getting a bunch of new features for Android phones and Pixels, this month, it seems like. So good news, I guess, for those of us on Android and Pixel.
Good news from Google all around. Let's move on to some other news real quick. Over the weekend, the Golden Globes happened, and entirely over Zoom and remote. And I haven't watched this entire thing, but by all reports, it is some kind of disaster. Oh, Sherlyn, what's up?
Okay, so generally I don't watch a lot of awards shows unless like one of my friends are throwing a watch party or something. Anyway, they're usually fun if you're like there for the red carpet arrival and that sort of stuff. Obviously, with the pandemic this year, this couldn't really happen. And so the Golden Globes was sort of a hybrid event. And I feel like it was kind of similar to, was it the Oscars that happened fairly recently during the pandemic? It was somewhat similar in that it was also a hybrid event. Like there were people who took the stage to
It
do,
wasn't the
like,
Oscars. We didn't have that yet. That was
It was another. I can't remember which award show it was, but there was an award show I remember where, like, anyway. but it was similar in the sense that like you'd have one person on an actual stage and who was actually there, and then you had like these people zooming in, video conferencing in. So it was kind of a fun like way to look at what some of these celebrities and famous people and what their Zoom setups were like, and that like kind of went viral. But also it was a complete mess. Like it just there were like Daniel Kaluuya, when he was accepting his award for Judas and the Black Messiah, if I'm not wrong, was on mute.
Yeah,
was muted for a full like 30 seconds, and then when he finally came back or was brought back, he said, "Y'all played me dirty," and I was like, "Yeah, yeah, they sure did."
Oh man. And also like what I saw was like there were points where a lot of the nominees were just hanging out together in like a separate Zoom room, and before commercials, like they would just go to that room without warning people, like, hey, by the way, you're on camera now. So you would just see random people just talking like a boring Zoom conversation. It seemed like a complete disaster. I was just thinking about like our wonderful video team here at Verizon Media is able to like manage our live show every week so gracefully. And these Golden Globes folks like just didn't think about a lot of aspects of how these shows, like what it would actually look like on TV and how it'd be presented. Yeah. Anyway, you can watch this disaster on Hulu
Hulu. Yeah, it's on Hulu. And it was, by the way, hosted by Tina Fey, Amy Poehler. Mm-hmm. I actually didn't watch it yet, so I don't know if they did a good job or not, but I'm sure they did. The best line, though, the best line that kind of went viral or made it into a meme anyway was like, Tina Fey, I think, saying, couldn't this all have just been an email? And I'm like, 2020 vibes in 2021.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. And worth pointing out, like this also follows like news from the LA Times about like the sheer corruption in the Hollywood Foreign Press Association and all that. So go check out that reporting. It is not a great organization, and the Golden Globes are kind of a joke, but we still give it legitimacy every year. It is infuriating to me. Let's talk about something that actually matters. It seems like China and India are kind of in conflict a bit, and especially China is kind of using its influence to just kind of hint to India that, hey, we can use our malware to hurt your electrical grid. So maybe let's not fight as much. What is going on there, Sherlyn?
So basically, India and China have been involved in border skirmishes for a while. What happened, I think, in the last few months, I can't remember the exact timeline, but they got bad. And there were like a dozen people killed over these border skirmishes. Right around the time that happened, parts of India started to see their power go out. I believe Bellevue, Seattle-based cybersecurity firm was looking into some of that and noticed that there was basically malware in the Indian power grid, and it seemed to come from China. And so it was pretty crazy to think that like a country has control over another country's power grid. You think when I think it was like Texas had a power outage, not power outage, but like the winter storm just destroyed everything. Failed. Imagine that being compounded by having some other country have control of your power
or being attacked. And
that's insane.
This is something we've been talking about for a while. We talked about that one Florida town where somebody did hack into the water, you know, purification system, and they were able to catch this before they poisoned the water supply. But it was like a proof of concept. They proved that they could get into that water system. This follows a lot of stuff too when it comes to cyber warfare, and we talked about that, I think, last year pre-pandemic and everything, but this is how countries are kind of dealing with conflicts. And you could go back to Stuxnet and what the US government and Iran did, or did with Iran's like nuclear program, I believe. And it's all kind of all ties back together. I do think like we're starting to see the point where this stuff affects real people, because China, this malware was affecting hospitals. It was affecting, you know, important things and important institutions during the middle of a pandemic. So just somebody hacking into a power supply could risk lives, you know, and could cause further injury to people. So it's crazy. This is the world we're in. But I want to point out, like, this stuff is happening. You may not hear about it as much compared to a lot of other things, but I hope we're thinking about our own like infrastructure, and other countries are thinking about their, you know, infrastructure security better. Yeah.
To bring in a little bit of perspective here, like Singapore is freaking tiny. We're surrounded by water, but not potable water. And we have very few like lakes or anything. We barely have a lake. We have reservoirs. So we're actually super reliant on Malaysia, which was our former, like we used to be a part of Malaysia and we're no longer a part of Malaysia, but we are super reliant on them for supply of drinking water, actually. So there's like giant pipes that run across what we call the causeway, which is this bridge that links the two together. And like the goal of the Singapore government has always to be like, no, we need to find an alternative source of water for our entire country, because you cannot rely on another country for something as vital as your source of drinking water. And similarly, India cannot afford to have China be infiltrating its power grid. So whether it's India needing to step up its cybersecurity and its privacy measures, or also China just needs to not be a dick. But there's just so much here to really think about. There's just basically countries, governments, cannot use outdated tech. Just stop using your outdated, super insecure tech.
This is something we brought up before too, and I do think like moving forward, we need to start treating cyber, like we need to start treating malware like this that can cause cyber attacks, almost like nuclear weapons. Like there needs to be like more of a understanding and a broad, a broad set of rules that every country kind of acknowledges when it comes to this stuff, because just a couple people hitting buttons in China can lead to deaths in other country. And like that seems kind of crazy to me. We are not prepared for kind of what all this stuff means. Let's move on to another quick story that, I guess a big story that dropped this morning, right before our podcast. Square is buying a majority stake in Tidal for the equivalent of like $297 million in cash and stock. Let me say that again. Square, the online payments processor, the company behind Cash App, now owns Tidal, the music service. I'm just very, there's a lot of like, going on this morning. I woke up to this news. There's a photo of like Jack Dorsey and Jay-Z in a dining room together with wine, and just like it's begging you to like just caption it of like what they're thinking of each other. So I think Dorsey is kind of positioning this as a way to like, you know, pay artists more directly. I don't, you know, this guy is just like a billionaire with his fingers in many pies at this point. And people talk about him like splitting his attention between Square and Twitter and not really paying attention to Twitter. And this just seemed like another thing that he's going to be playing with. I don't know what this means. This is very strange to me. I have been thinking that like Tidal as a standalone company probably can't stick around for too long, just because there is so much, like Spotify has much more money. Like there's so much stronger competition, and Tidal is all about like high quality music from like that's owned directly by a lot of artists. So they were trying for something very specific. I did not see this end coming, but I don't know. Let's see where it goes from here.
Talking about paying artists and Jack Dorsey and that sort of stuff, it reminds me of something we haven't yet talked about on this podcast, I think, which is the rumor or the testing of tipping on Twitter. Which sounds very much like what like Jack Dorsey seems to be trying to do here with artists on music services like
super
Tidal.
Followers. So, yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, you get rewarded for being on their platform by getting money from these followers.
Yeah.
So
that's, we should talk about that at some point. Like, that is like a fundamental, it does kind of go together. You're right. And it does, I don't, like, as a person in media, I'm not going to be doing super followers or anything, but I think for a lot of creators and artists, it could be a thing. It's an alternative to like the newsletters that a lot of, even journalists, like a lot of people are moving towards to get paid. I'm all about people getting paid, so that's fine. Don't just produce content for free on Twitter. But yeah, this, I'm still trying to wrap my head around the title thing. I don't know what a lot of this means, but yeah, expect more commentary and stuff coming soon. I feel like everybody's spending their morning just wrapping their heads around this news. So do you have anything to add on this, Sherlyn?
No, not on this, but I know that there's a bit of news that broke last night, too, after we were done planning this episode that got me a little bit stoked. I don't know if I'm stoked or not yet, but Dev, do you want to tell people what it is?
Sure. Like, so there have been rumors that Nintendo's working on a more powerful or larger Switch, and I feel like it is coming into fruition right now because Bloomberg reported last night that Nintendo has begun production of a Switch with a 7-inch OLED screen. Samsung is producing the screens. We don't have many details about the hardware. It sounds like it's still going to be 720p in portable mode, but that OLED screen means things are going to look a lot better. Colors are going to pop more. There's going to be a lot better contrast, and certainly daylight play is going to be better. It should use less energy. But the other kicker is that when it's docked, it should output 4K, which raises a lot of questions. I don't think, like, I feel like this can't be the Switch 2 or something, right? I don't think Nintendo's going to bifurcate. Yeah. Well, Switch 2 would mean a full sequel, right? I don't think we're there. It is probably something more like a Switch Pro or the name I'd like to see, the Super Switch. Like a slightly more powerful, slightly more modern, you know, device that still plays all the existing Switch games. And I don't think Nintendo's going to leave the Switch hardware behind anytime soon. Like, developers will still have to target the original Switch that was released, what, 5 years ago at this point? So we're kind of getting there, or 4 years ago, I guess. It is getting a little old, but I think as a platform, it's very healthy. Like, there are still great games coming out. Graphically, sure, it can't keep up with the PS5 and Xbox Series X, but that's never been the point of the Switch, and I don't think Nintendo has to play that game. Maybe for that 4K docked functionality, that could have slightly better upscaling than what the Switch has now. Because actually, there are a couple companies that are basically producing these little dongles that attach to the Switch's HDMI port to kind of sharpen the graphics, just like add a little better upscaling. So I could see that being a thing. I cannot imagine a Switch powering a like an actual 4K rendered game. That seems ridiculous. At the very least, I feel like Nintendo just needs to target 1080p, a smooth, like solid 60 FPS. If they can manage that, then that's going to be great for anybody, and you can upscale that to 4K just fine. Are you thinking of upgrading at this point, Sherlyn? Like, what are you so excited about here?
I still am not very sure if this is a 4K TV, to be honest, that I have over here in my house, even though it's a new one. I think it's a 1080p LED.
It depends on how old it is, but yeah, we can always Google your model number and we'll see.
Pretty old. It's pretty 1080p, pretty sure. But so for me, functionally, that would be useless upgrade. Yeah. And also, I haven't traveled with my Switch a lot. Back when I first got it, oh god, at the start of 2020, I was planning to travel with it. And then in those cases, the 7-inch OLED would make a difference. Right now, though, I'm not so sure. I don't know if I'm going to get one the second it comes out yet. But it's exciting just because, you know, of all the console, sort of consoles,
this is
the one that I have. Yeah. I love it.
I get it. It's kind of, I mean, I feel like I just reviewed the Switch Lite, you know, that doesn't feel like it was that long ago. So if it ends up being a portable device that is maybe slightly bigger than the Switch Lite, but not as chunky as the original Switch, like with the slimmer bezels and that OLED screen, I do feel like people are going to jump on that. It does remind me of like the long lost PS Vita. That console was amazing. It had a beautiful OLED screen, and I'm still sad Sony killed that. So that felt like our precursor to the Switch almost, because that was such a powerful, good-looking console. But yeah, we'll be keeping an eye on this. Maybe we'll have a new Switch soon. Let's move on to what we've been working on.
I can't wait.
Just a bunch of stuff. This week has been super busy for me. So I covered the Microsoft Mesh news. Go check out my reporting around that. I am working on a gadget piece and something we called an IRL about how we live with devices around the Arlo cameras, specifically the Arlo video doorbell and some of the outdoor cameras. So that's going to be a quick thing. I found that to be super useful around my home because I didn't want Ring cameras. And I'm also going to be working on a list of like things you can buy if you've just picked up a new OLED TV. Sherlyn, what's up with you?
I have been working on, so fair warning to my friends who are always looking for secrets, there will be a lot of stuff coming up. Let's just put this out there. Y'all are going to be excited.
There are gadgets. You know? Gadgets are coming.
There are gadgets. But right now, we're still in a half lull, half like I can do whatever I want. So a very interesting product was announced this week. I can finally talk about it. The Gatorade GX sweat patch. It was announced on Monday. I have been testing it for a few days. And boy, oh boy, oh boy.
I have a question.
Devendra, tell me your questions first.
I mean, what the hell is this? Why would I want a patch from Gatorade on my skin? Like, this feels like a idiocracy joke. You know, it feels like it's just something to tell you you need more electrolytes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It weird as heck. It is weird. And Gatorade, right? Yeah. They want to get you to be drinking more of their juice punch things. So
sugar water.
They made sugar water, electrolyte patch, whatever. So basically, they made this patch that you stick on your inner forearm. It's like a, I don't even, bigger than most coins, but small, like, that's almost thumb like size patch.
A big square Band-Aid almost. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a big square Band-Aid. And then you stick it on your skin, and there's a dye pack on the underside that as you sweat, it will fill up the patch and show like how much you've sweat and like what the composition of your sweat is to know if you, you know, how much you need to hydrate back and what your body's sodium output or loss is.
So it's kind of like a UX. It's UI for your water loss, which I feel like is just sweat. Literally sweat, like nature's UI for telling us we need more water is to sweat.
Yeah. Yeah. It's your notification, your alert, right? Mm-hmm. Here's the issue, which is for this story, I have received four patches to test. One of them just did not work because I am not a sweaty person. I just I'm all flowers and fresh air.
Until we go to Taiwan for CompuServe or CompuTech.
Yeah, and then that's like freaking, that's oh my God. Maybe because I grew up in Singapore and that's what I'm used to. And that's when I will sweat. So I don't sweat a lot.
You should have gone to a sauna. You must have a sauna in your fancy apartment building.
I wish. I wish I could have said that I could be bougie enough to be like, I have a sauna. So no. So I had to do a lot of like studies. I did a lot of looking up like what causes difference in sweating between people and climate and stuff like that. So yes, men generally tend to sweat more than women do. You obviously sweat in more in warmer temperatures and more like the different climates. And then, you know, depending on the activity. So according to Gatorade, this patch will only work outside if the temperature is between 46 and like 75 degrees, which I don't know why there's an upper limit.
Useless.
There shouldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense, but I'm not going to question that too much because we didn't hit 75 here in the New York area. But I was working out at the gym for like an hour and a half, and my gym's like between that, like within that range, and I just did not sweat enough. I took a photo of it and it was like, sorry, no data, B word.
Work harder.
And I was like, shoot, I was like telling our editor, I was like, this first patch didn't work. He was like, work harder. I was like, I just don't sweat a lot. So the second time I tried to test it, I had to bump up my apartment temperature to like the highest my thermostat would
go.
Would
do it.
And
It was sort of.
And then I started working out at home and I did, listener, viewer, all of you, swear to God, I did like, what did I do? I did like, okay, a few like Oculus 2 Supernatural workouts, which in the past usually makes me sweat a lot. Sweat was pouring down my face, my neck, my back, but not my inner forearm. I don't sweat on my inner forearm.
I'm very confused. So, about, are these things one-time use? Like how often are you switching these up? Okay.
So every time you use them, you they're disposable, you dispose of them. So I managed to get a result finally after doing a HIIT workout, which I hate. I hate HIIT, but I did a HIIT workout in my burning
high
apartment.
Intensity training workout?
High intensity interval training, mm-hmm, yes. Mm-hmm. So finally got some results, but I still basically don't sweat a lot. So y'all are going to get a very sweaty video from me soon enough. I'm going to test it again today for a video.
Yeah.
Stay tuned for
Let
that.
Let me just it will say, be, for the yeah. record, I hate this. And I feel like this thing should burn in a fire because this is exactly what we need. Disposable tech from Gatorade to tell you to drink more Gatorade. This is everything that's wrong with us right now.
It's a good line I shall use in my article later today. But anyway, that's coming. I'm working on that and a bunch of other stuff that's coming up that I can't talk about just yet. So stay tuned for all of that.
Very cool. Well, let me give you a break, Sherlyn, so you can catch your breath and switch your Gatorade patches. Let's move on to our pop culture picks. I'll talk about what I've been watching. One thing I think everybody should see is the Billie Eilish documentary that is on Apple TV Plus right now. It's called The World's a Little Blurry. This thing is 2.5 hours long. It is so long, it actually has an intermission in the middle, which is pretty wild. But it's a documentary that looks at Billie Eilish's career kind of from as she was becoming popular and before as she was working on Bad Guy at the beginning and then post-Grammys, post like her super popularity, and kind of cuts between early and later Billie Eilish. And I love her music. I love like the work relationship she has with her brother Phineas. It's a really just if you dig her music, I think you'll find a lot to like here. I think it is a good enough documentary to really get more people into her stuff. And I just want to say I really like her family. It's really cute because she travels, you know, she tours with her mom and her dad, and they're all like very supportive and very earnest and very like emotionally aware, which is something we don't typically see with very young, successful pop artists, right? Like either the parents are too demanding or the parents are like absent and then they have terrible people around them. But it kind of seems like, you know, I think they're probably just still living in the same old like tiny house that she grew up in LA. It's all very modest. Like they're very like, I don't know. They seem like a nice family, just like a very sweet family. They were both homeschooled, both she and her brother, so they never actually went to real school. So her parents like clearly made some choices for them along those lines. But this at least seems like a sweet story of a family dealing with their daughter becoming a super huge, tremendous pop star and how she deals with that. There's a moment here. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, I'm curious if you've watched any of the other recent celebrity documentaries, like the Paris Hilton one, the Britney Spears one.
I saw a bit of the Britney Spears one.
I was going to see how that compared.
I saw a bit of the Britney Spears one. That one is more about deconstructing like how we treated Britney Spears, whereas this
the
one's
media,
like,
yeah.
Billie Eilish is on the rise. What, you know, how is this affecting her? So it's more personal, I'd say. And I think it's more hopeful because the Britney Spears one also just made me really sad about our media culture.
Yeah.
We'll say like there are a couple points during this movie where it's just like you start to realize how young Billie Eilish is. Like at some point she runs into Orlando Bloom, who just like, you know, meets her and says, "Oh, I love your work and everything." And he kisses her. And later she's like, "Who's that? Who's that guy?"
No.
And then people
My
like to be
OG
like,
crush.
And then people Orlando like to be like, "Oh, he was the guy in Pirates of the Caribbean." And she's like, "Oh, why doesn't
Lord
he,
of the Rings.
Why doesn't he look like that anymore?" Just like absolutely dragging these stars. It's kind of
she was really excited to see Justin Bieber.
Oh man, the Justin Bieber moment, which is I'm not a huge Justin Bieber fan. I don't know really too many young, you know, teens or tweens that are, but she was somebody who was obsessed with him to the point where like she would fantasize about him being her boyfriend. So there's a section in the middle of this movie where she meets Justin Bieber for the first time, just the way she like falls apart. Just like it is pure just bawling into her arms, and like he comes across as a pretty good guy and this like he's pretty sweet and supportive and gives her support as like, "I know what you're going through. You've never like this is world changing and everything." Like he's there to kind of step her along the way. It's all very sweet stuff like that, and I'm hoping for the best for Billie Eilish and her family, because I feel like bad things tend to happen to young stars when they get super popular really quickly. I'm thinking of like Amy Winehouse and a lot of other folks, and this does not seem like that story. So yeah, it's great. Check out this documentary. It's on Apple TV Plus right now. And I also want to mention, just real quick, Lee Isaac Chung's movie Minari is out on video on demand. We just reviewed it on the /Filmcast. It's about a Korean family who immigrates to America, with the dream of starting a farm in Arkansas. And it is a film that's very much about like the immigrant dream, the American dream, and also, yeah, very specifically about Asian families coming here and dealing with a country that finds them all very, very different and out of sorts with the rest of America. I found it really lovely. Like, I found a lot to relate to as well, because I immigrated to this country with my family. Our experiences are very similar. Not the farming thing, but also just feeling out of sorts in America. This movie also has a great performance from Steven Yeun, who I think I love. I love as an actor. It's also really weird to go from a movie like Burning, where he plays like a elite sociopath, like just like an upper crusty psychopath in a way, but quietly a psychopath, to this movie where he is just like a good, like a dad, like a good immigrant dad with like immigrant dad energy. He's very sweet. He's kind of tough at times. Like it goes places. Like the marriage is not fully together because of the struggles of immigrating to America and just surviving here. So I highly recommend it. I think this is one of those $20 rentals right now, but if you've got the money, if you haven't spent much on movies, you know, over the past year, it is worth checking out. It's a very sweet film. It's called Minari. Sherlyn, what have you been watching?
I have been spending the last few days, I guess, catching up on old stuff. So don't have fresh stuff by way of recommendations for you guys. But I did set aside two things. So I've also been going a little crazy ham on Duolingo because I decided to.
productive gamifying. Good for you, exactly. Good for you. Yeah.
So instead of learning just one language at a time, like most normal people, I am currently learning three. Made like a bunch of progress in Spanish. So I'm like, all right, I need a bit of a challenge. So I decided to re-up my Japanese. And so like I'm back on Japanese. And also I started to learn Korean. And Korean, I know people say or think it's easy. Gosh, it's hella hard to learn Korean. It's ridiculous.
I thought you were going to be like, I'm going to go French next and just do all the really hard languages all together. Like, that's you're really going to test yourself. Yeah.
I was very lucky to grow up having, like, being just fluent in Mandarin, which is one of the most difficult languages to learn. But anyway, so Korean, and then I re-upped my Bahasa, which is Indonesian. And it's interesting to see how dual, and then also for fun, I decided to take on Chinese because I wanted to be like, Duolingo, you're wrong. That's not how Chinese people say this thing. Duolingo definitely teaches you awkward ways to say things. Let's just put it that way. But it is still a good way to familiarize yourself with like all these basics of a language. I feel confident if I were to go to Spain again for MWC that I can get around just fine. Nice. And yeah, so I mean, I know we're not going anywhere yet, but we are soon.
You're ready to go everywhere. You're ready to go from Spain to Japan to Korea and then back home.
To Indonesia. Amazing. Yeah. So why not? Why not pick up a language now? You got like about quite a few months left to pick up a new language. There's leaderboards. I'm at the top of my leaderboard right now. Because
you're really
channeling
your overachieving school energy here. So I love it. Totally. Love to see it. Anything else?
Yes. One more thing, which is I wanted to let you help relax. YouTube recommended this to me last night, which is how I came across this. This is called a channel called The Icing Artist. And it's basically this woman who's really good at decorating cakes and cookies and other pastries. And it's so therapeutic in a way that like, it's art. It's just art, right? And it's not like a TikTok video where it's over in, I don't know, under a minute. This is like a full on 10-minute video where she's just like putting the finishing touches or like just taking a cake that's so basic and then making it look like, I don't know, Legos or whatever. I first watched the series of her turning $20 grocery store cakes into $500 wedding cakes. And I'm just like, what? Did you know you could stuff flowers into a cake to upgrade the hell out of them? No, I did not know this. Uh-huh. You could gold leaf onto a cake. It's also very nice.
The everything is cake meme. You're just like really leading into
exactly.
that now. Yeah.
Exactly.
You want everything to be cake.
Yeah, when you're not hungry, when you're like, you know, on a full stomach and you're just wanting to relax and, you know, just watch some art. And she's really cool. She's not like, there's a whole like process to her, to how she does all of these things. It's not just like a competition baking show thing. It's really just for you to watch how a cake gets decorated. I found it very therapeutic. So enjoy The Icing Artist on YouTube. Well, that's it for our episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. This podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter and chatting about movies and TV on the /filmcast at /film.com. I was also on Twit this week chatting about all sorts of stuff, so check that out at twit.tv.
If you want to test me on the 5 to 7 languages I'm currently learning, you can hit me up. I'm at Sherlyn Low on Twitter. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. Target the muffin shoes business idea. You heard it here first.